You're listening to St. Pete X. Today's episode is brought to you by Cityverse. Cityverse brings the community together on a new civic platform powered by Catalyst News. St. Pete Cityverse is launching soon. You can learn more and reserve your home space at cityverse.life. Now, enjoy the conversation. Joining me today on SPX is restaurateur, brewer, entrepreneur, podcast host, Beers with Fred, Fred Forsley. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Joe.
We have had some good conversations because we like to do a lot of things. I think you do more things than I do. Let's start by getting a rundown of the brands and endeavors and dozen plus restaurants and everything under your umbrella.
Yeah. Well, actually, I started in real estate. So I have a brand called Harborview Properties in Maine. I've got about 12 brokers. I was a broker when I was 18, 19 years old and kind of was the foundation of my entrepreneurial experience. And that led me into the beer business. And we got Shipyard Brewing Company, which was founded in 1992 in Kennebunk, Port Harbor in Maine. It's the birthplace Shipyard, Federal Jacks, and Kennebunkport Brewing is in a 20,000 square foot real estate location right on the harbor in Kennebunkport, Maine. And then I also got involved in Sea Dog Brewing Company, which was started by the Camplin family, and we actually bought it out of bankruptcy in 2000. And that has 9 locations. And then we came up with a root beer soda brand that became Captain Eli's, my dad's name and my son's name, but it was named originally after my dad. And he's had a family recipe for root beer. And so he was a veteran, World War II Navy, and we've done a few comic books around it and had some fun. So I've been in business for about 33 years in the beer business and about 44 years in real estate. And it's led, there's a few other things, ventures that I've gotten involved in recently. This Alt Beverage, which is a hemp-based THC product, was solvent-free, which is really key to mention because a lot of the brands are, they use solvents to extract the THC, and it's all natural, only 30 calories. And actually it's being distributed locally here by Great Bay. And then, so I've ventured in a variety of other things, but those are the primary things. And
Ice Pick Vodka.
Ice Pick Vodka. It's actually growing rapidly and doing well. And I've actually trademarked some other names in the spirits business that we're going to be doing in the future too. But Ice Pick is a brand that we've started before COVID, and we took some hits during COVID on supply chain things, but I feel like we're relaunching, and we just launched with Pepin over in Tampa, and we're in Maine and New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and then we're going to launch throughout the rest of the country. And
we enjoyed Ice Picks at Park Shore Grill a couple of nights ago.
Right, we did. And yeah, what's nice about this town and community, St. Pete, is how easily I've been able to meet friends and actually feel like yourself. We only met a few months ago, and then quickly a lot of the same interests, and Pat O'Hara and guys like Mike Endo, I'm both different entrepreneurs in their own way, but I feel like I've known those guys my whole life, you know, and I've met a number of people in this town that we've become friends. I've been in St. Pete for like 9 years. I lived in Snowbird. I go back and forth, but basically my permanent residence is here in St. Pete and love it. I love this community. It's really, in my opinion, one of the best places in the world to be, especially in January and February, March.
So a lot to dig in there, but I want to go straight back to being a broker is no joke. I mean, you have to, you know, be a regular agent first, then jump through 10,000 more hoops to become a broker. So to be a broker at 18 or 19 is pretty extraordinary. So what did 12 and 13 look like for you that led you to be a broker by the time you're, you know, what were those teenage entrepreneurial endeavors?
Dad and mom ran a home for veterans, and it was, even though it was a boarding home, but it was a little bit entrepreneurial. You got to learn how to run a business because back then, you know, kids didn't have a choice. If their parents told them they were working, I never got paid. And, you know, so you'd do side jobs to get paid. And I realized early on that I wanted to work for myself from the experience of having to listen and do jobs that I had to do or side jobs. And I got lucky and I met a friend of mine who actually started real estate right out of high school, Mike Liberty in Gray, Maine. And he basically said, you know, you should really get your real estate license and you'll be able to find properties for me. And we did. So that's what started it. Yeah.
So he was an investor and then you were doing the work for him to help him source some places to get into.
Yeah. Yeah. And he got into government housing and we had, you know, very quickly had done a lot of deals. And so we were on that roller coaster of the real estate game in the '80s. And then Reagan did the retroactive tax law change, which just decimated real estate, led to the SNL debacle. And so everybody had tough times were in real estate then, but that actually created opportunities to buy. And so I've been through three or four ups and downs over the last 40 years in which really, the opportunities are when things get a little tough and crazy. And that,
if you have a little cash, you can jump in.
Or if you don't have cash, you know people with cash. Yeah. So I have fortunate to have a partner, Gordon Hirschbees, who's a bit older than me, close to 21 years older at the time the game was tough. And he allowed me the ability to, and I would find a deal and he would invest. And together we would own the property. And we had some great successes with that. And I assisted him on some of his businesses. Yeah, he was the largest recycler in the state of Maine at one time. And I would deal with the banks and deal with the business aspects of it. He was really able to foresee and run businesses, but he wasn't real good with the banks and lawyers. And I had learned that at an early age. So
you, have you ever had a W-2 paycheck?
Well, when I paid myself through my own
company. Okay, but yeah. That's it though. So never from somebody else.
In college, I worked for Coach Brock at Arizona State and I got a paycheck there, but that was about it.
So do you remember the transition between, so if you were, you know, if you're sourcing, I say Mr. Liberty, because it's a cool name, you're sourcing properties for him, you're getting a commission for that. When did you transition into start looking for your own deals or think about owning your own properties?
Well, what happened was my mom and dad get sick. My mom had always had MS, but she always was able to, she was a driven woman and she was running the boarding home. But then my dad got really sick, passed away, and I had to run the boarding home. So all of a sudden I had to focus on that. So on the side, I then started to do my own deals. And that's what kind of sparked it, because I went from, you know, really focused in one area, because we used to find government housing projects or build them, find land and build. And so that's what kind of sparked it. And I actually bought a building from Gordon Hirschbees and flipped it and made some money. And then he said, geez, how'd you do that? And we met and he had a big landfill in northern Maine and it needed some assistance because he had some partners that had gotten into some trouble with the way they were operating. And so I ended up at a young age having to go in and renegotiate that deal for him. Yeah.
So, you know, as a real estate investor, can you talk a little bit about your process? What do you look for? So, you know, when you examine a deal, what's your process for
that? It's so funny. The first thing you learn, and anybody that's had many real estate classes, is location, location, location. And in my life, that's really played to be true. You know, it's like, where is that geographically located? Is in a spot you think is going to ultimately be successful because of something's moving there, or that, you know, you can always make more money if you can buy when the market hasn't trended up yet. But, you know, they always just say buy the worst house on the best neighborhood because that's going to give you the best upside. But when I've gotten hurt in deals, it's usually been because I didn't do enough homework on the real estate location. Like I got hurt down here in Clearwater on Highway 19. I bought a location from the bank. Actually, I got a great deal on the building, but it was on Enterprise right across from the mall. And I didn't realize, and I should have done more research, but they, you know, 19 completely got ripped up. So I did this beautiful renovation for a brew pub. The day we opened, they had bulldozers out front just sitting there. And that was, I've never seen a worse run construction job in my life. And I think it would have been very successful had that not have happened, but that location was painful when we sold it ultimately. It's not a bad location, but that construction redesigned how you got to that location, made it very tricky. But so I didn't make necessarily thought I made the worst decision buying it. So you got to look for, in my opinion, I always, because I've got some young guys I'm mentoring, I say, try to read the deed, try to read the, you know, restrictions, what can you do, what can't you do? And then really, what is the zoning? And then what is the mentality of the zoning in the community? I mean, are they, I've changed zones before, I've gotten contract zones, I've, you know, it really comes down to what's the will of the community, you know, and you have neighbors that are going to fight whatever you're doing, or are they going to embrace it? And those things can matter and cost you money if you don't have the community behind you. So I've gotten TIFs before, tax incremental financing, and had to get, you know, really dilapidated where we put the brewery in 92. We were in Kennebunkport, Maine, and then 30 miles north is Portland. And we needed to expand, and I found an industrial site that was abandoned and it was in a rough shape and it had environmental issues. But because of my background dealing with a recycling company and we had a secure landfill, I had dealt with contaminated soils and I understood people that knew how to deal with it. So I could bring value to that property. I got it at a huge discount for 4 acres overlooking the harbor. And to this day, now is like $180 million real estate development, mainly because of location, location, location is where now became the place people wanted to be. But I had to give up a lot to get there. But at the same time, it's there and we're still there. The brewery's still there. But the people you have to work through and relationships, it's like when you're almost, you have so many different key points you have to cover off on, you know, not only getting financing and money, getting through the approval process, getting through the entitlements, trying to build something that at the right time will fit what the demand is out there and what you're trying to build is so critical, similar to some of the things you're working on right now, you know, you're with your science center and some of these other programs. It's if you can gain support, but you've got to make sure when you get it done, you've got commitments for people to use it and all the other pieces, you know. So it's, you know, it's amazing when you see, you know, you've been in business a little while to see things that have transformed. Down in Florida, things can move quickly on transportation changes like highways and things like that. Not so much in New England. You don't often get that kind of movement in New England. So here, you know, knowing what the DOT, FDOT and others are doing, I would have been better served on knowing better on 19, what was going on Highway 19, but on that deal. But then also, it's important to keep informed and communicate and then, but at the same time, you know, really find the right business structure, you know, on deals. So I got fortunate to find my location at Treasure Island. At the time, the city was kind of realized that that site was a tough site because it had sat vacant for, I think, close to 12 years. And I got a lot of encouragement from the city. At the last minute, I had a problem with the FDOT because I actually didn't get a permit from them. And I actually called Robin Miller, who then called somebody in the governor's office, who then got the FDOT to take off the stop work order. And then $10,000 later of fees and applications and everything else, I got restarted. But that was a week before we were already ready to open. I had hired everybody. And so you have these things happen to you. And, you know, it's the key is to be able to adjust and talk to people and get things solved. Because no matter what, something's going to happen to you that you'll have to, adversity that you'll have to readjust and deal with.
But not with the Science Center. That'll run perfectly, right?
That'll be easy. That looked like such an easy project. Yeah, I'm surprised it's not open. When are you going to open it next month, right?
Yeah, as long as you don't mind being in a tent that I put up in the
well, they have the, you know, somebody had an original vision and you're, you know, rejuvenating that vision. And you, I think science and education and giving that, it's so impactful for that to be able to have access for kids, you know, so hopefully that'll keep going.
But there's a thread with the Science Center. It wasn't something I set out to do. It was an opportunity that was presented to me. And I think there's a thread of opportunism in how you operate as well. You mentioned buying Sea Dog out of bankruptcy. You had that site that sat vacant where you ended up ultimately putting the Treasure Island location. You mentioned the land that had some problems. And I think even you got into the restaurant business out of somebody that owed you some money, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of opportunism in there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it upsets my wife a lot. You know what I mean? She'd be like, why didn't you just stick on the real estate? Why did you have to get into these I mean, I think part of it is I grew up in a situation where it was like, okay, there's not a problem, there's a solution. What's the solution? What are we going to do here? And that just came from the way my mother was, basically. Like, she would plow through issues, even though she had MS. She would never talk about it. She was just, okay, let's get this done, let's get that done. And she was very civic orientated and involved in the, we had a, grew up in a small town. It was, I think at the time there might have been 3,500 people in Gray, Maine. And so you could make a difference in the community and that type of thing.
Definitely have that here.
Yeah.
Not as much as 3,500
first
in town, but.
What I love about here, though, is it wasn't in, I mean, I lived in Winter Park for a little bit, Florida. It's a beautiful little town. And it just seemed like you didn't have the same ability to make impacts. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's very giving. A lot of people give back to the community here.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff I do in theory in like a sharky kind of environment, I have no business doing it, and it probably would have been really, really painful. And the opposite happened here. I was like, saw a need with earnestness, filled the need, and the community supported it. It was just, you know, very, I guess, I think it's Midwestern values, you know, really coming down here, but I do think it's a special place in that regard.
Yeah, in the future, you just feel the energy here. You know, there's such an energy around here. And I think some people may not feel it as much if they've been here a long time. They haven't lived in some areas that really aren't as wanting of the new energy. It's frustrating because some of these things can take so much energy to, you know, whether the Rays are going to stay, whether they're going to go, what they're going to do with the property, da, 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 da. But, you know, we saw people on the pier project. I think in the end, people felt, well, it could be a variety of different things. But when I walked down there, the energy that's there, the people that are enjoying it, just seems like they kind of nailed it as far as community involvement. It's not like it's a pier sitting there with nobody going out on it. I go out there and it's just amazing, the energy and what the community created. There's always a thing where you could say, well, it could have been done better, or this could have happened better, or that. But in reality, I think when you look around, there's so much opportunity to make this city just even more livable. And I'm excited about the future here.
Yeah. So one interesting purview you've had is the explosion of the brewery business. When you got started, there were, relative to what there are now, a handful, and now there's 100x that. So kind of walk us through the environment when you started brewing and how it's changed.
When we started, Alan Pugsley, he's English, he was consulting to a variety of people that wanted to open breweries. And I think I was probably the 90th brewery in the country at the time. And that was counting and it got down. Jimmy Carter changed the law for Billy beer so his brother could have a beer of his own without having a brewery. And it affected the way the brewery laws were with the three-tier system. So Jimmy Carter made a big difference with his presidency in beer, for sure, if anybody. So at the time, it got down to 50 breweries in the country. And then Sierra Nevada opened up on the West Coast, and you had Anchor Steam on the West Coast. And then Portland, Maine, you had David Gary found Alan Pugsley in England, and he came and opened up Gary's Brewery in Portland, Maine. And then Alan opened up a few others. So in mid-90, I met Alan, and we opened up in 92, June 15th. And he, at that time, wasn't my partner, but I realized that I didn't want to be the brewer every day after doing it for a bit. And that's when, on a handshake, he became my partner. And at that time, I think there might have been three or four breweries in the state of Maine. Now there's 150 breweries in the state of Maine. And Maine is not, you know, it's vacation land, but it's, you know, year round. The population's about 1.4 million, 1.5 million. And half those people don't go out of the house. You know what I mean? It's like we're the oldest state in the country. And anyways, Maine has become a great beer community, a lot because of Alan consulted, and then a lot of the people that used to work for us went and started their own breweries. And we helped a lot of people over the years. We trained a lot of people, and there was such a communal feeling about it. And like 10 years ago, I kind of felt a shift in that. There was a bit of the younger group had a little bit of an attitude, and it just wasn't. And now you're starting to see really a fallout. And I think we're going to see, because a lot of people got into the beer business, think they were going to make a lot of money. And some did. You know, you had Lagunitas sold $1 billion. You had Ballast Point, same thing. And you had Funky Buddha, and you had Cigar City sold out. So most of the guys, my contemporaries, have sold out. And, you know, I love the beer business. It's fun, challenging. It was more profitable. It really been tough since, you know, gas prices really affect brewing because of prices on glass and transportation and then labor, the other big one. But so with gas prices coming down, the hope is it'll get a little bit, there'll be a little more profitability in it. But we find that I always have had a lot of fun in the business, and I'm seeing that some of that's coming back. We'll see what happens. And there's a big shift. That's why we did the, we've looked at ice pick vodka. We've looked at, and the goal is for us to get into every beverage. So.
Yeah. So in the stack, well, first I want to say in the media business, I can parallel it, right? When you used to have three stations and then cable came and now, you know, you have YouTube channels that are getting more than NBC. And it's sort of democratized the process, but the sort of underlying weirdness about that is people will go and spend their whole life making that content and being big, even if they don't make money, because they have a quality of life that it gives them, whether it's, you know, fame or ego value or just self-expression or whatever. And I think some of that, a lot of people just think having your own brewery is really cool, and they're willing to slog it out for years, break even, because they're the king of that little brew pub. And they're, you know, and so do you feel like that's a piece of it?
I think it's like, I said this to a friend of mine the other day. It's like the wine business, you know, it's like the old joke was, well, how do you make $1 million in the wine business? Start with three, right? Like it's the same thing. And I think that's it. If you really enjoy the business and you want your own little pub or tasting room, it's a great thing in addition to do is make your own beer. But, and when you actually figure out the math and figure it's a lot cheaper to buy beer from a distributor and sell it than it is to pay a brewer and have the equipment and all the other things, you better love what you do. Recently, my nephew, who's in his 30s, just got involved in Federal Jackson KBC, where we started Shipyard. And we actually are transitioning and sold him the brewery, and he's learning to brew. And he was a farrier before, working with horses. And he just, you know, it was nice because he loves working with his hands. He loves being active. And I think it's going to be a great way of life for him. And he grew up working in the brew pub, Federal Jack's. So all that's going to circle back for him, I think, and he can make a good living because the way it's set up, the model, the way the economics are set up. I see a lot of locations where the economics don't make sense. Like they just, whether their rent structure's wrong, you know, whether their setup on the brewery's wrong, or, you know, you got to size things correctly. And really, what is the goal of the location and the location? And all those things have to match up. And then you got to really enjoy it, you know. So I think that, you know, we could end up with maybe 3,000 breweries in the country. Maybe there's days where there's 7,000 and just better operated or in locations. It's tough because the distributors regulate. We have to get a distributor who will sell our product, and they can only handle so many brands. So with Pumpkinhead, I get a lot of mind share out of our distributor or across the country for that time period. But a lot of our other beers, we can't get it because they're dealing with so many other brands in their house. So having a good brew pub or a location where people will come, you know, is a great way to get your brand sold. And there's a brand called Treehouse in, I think it's in Franklin, Mass, or in Massachusetts somewhere. They don't sell any beer outside of their pubs. And people come there and buy their beer to go. And they've been very successful at that.
How many pubs is that?
I think they have like 4 or 5 now.
So you can be profitable as a brewer just on, I guess your operation can be quick.
They sell like 30,000 or 40,000 barrels, 31 gallons, and they sell it all to go and on site. So they've got, they just hit it and they've done a great job. So there are people that can. And again, it's the model. They were set up to, that's how they started the business and that's how they marketed it and that's how they kind of, let, you know, their beer was good and consumers would literally line up for it, but not everybody can do that. You know what I mean?
So when you look at launching a new item, you know, and there's the variables are the quality of the product, the brand, the distribution, the category, maybe the price point, maybe. So what's the most important and hardest to nail you know, if you say, if I could just make one of these, it'd be great and the rest will take care of itself, what variable is at the top of that list?
I think the quality of the beer, if you're talking about beer, I think it's the quality of the product itself, what's in the bottle. Because if you have a great name and a great thing and get it out there at a good price and people don't like it because it doesn't taste good, right, you're screwed ultimately. You know what I mean? It was like Three Stooges beers. Everybody had one of them and that's like, right. Oh, that's, you know, they didn't worry about what was in the bottle. And I think at the end of the day, that's the big thing. Like we provided a unique beer in our first beer shipyard export and it was different than most anything out there. Sam Adams was just starting and it was us. And when I would have somebody have one or two, if they had a third one, I know they were a customer for life. Right. If they took a sip and another sip and just didn't like it, well, they weren't going to try it ever again. But we were at a time where our beer was, it was a good recipe. The quality of the beer was there and it was consistent every time. In the early days, there were a lot of breweries that just didn't get it right. So they thought, all craft beer sucks. I'm not going to have that stuff. They put it all in a category. Over time, enough different beers were good. And then, I mean, I saw so many breweries go broke that didn't really have a great beer. I mean, Orlando Brewing Company, in the early days, it was an infected beer and nobody knew it unless you were a beer drinker and you knew it. And it was just like, people say, I don't like that beer. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, lactobacillus is what's, you know, in some of the Belgian beers and people grow a taste for it, but you know, your beer contaminated.
So there's enough justice in the world that if you make a really kick-ass beer, it will succeed most likely because of product that can get you there.
Yeah, and I think that's why some good brew pubs do really well if they don't sell on the outside is that people get so used to going there to, all right, I'm going to go there for my, like my buddies that own Gritty McDuff's in Portland, Maine, they have a beer, Black Fly Stout. I get a craving for it every once in a while. I'll go have a Black Fly Stout. And you can't buy it in the store. You can't have the same experience. And I like to say, drinking a beer is almost like having a good steak. It all has to match, right? You have to be the right environment, the right feeling, you know, everything clicks. If you, you know, you can have a good steak by yourself at home and it's not going to feel and experience isn't going to be the same, right? So if you can have a good beer with friends and you're sitting there talking and it just, it's the right temperature and everything clicks, this is the greatest thing in the world, right? And but at the same time, we talk about building community, right? Like, and if you go back in the history of whatever communities there were 600 years ago, there's a pub called the Royal Oak. It's in the New Forest in England, and we would go there, and the pub's been there for like 600-700 years, and it was really where everybody went to have town meetings. And they had a huge fireplace in there, and the pub was the way it's been for 600 years. And you walk in, you can literally feel that. And, you know, there's pictures of, you know, going back when they started to take pictures, but literally that's the stories have been kind of carried down about how that's where the community made all their big decisions were in the pubs. You know, it's kind of cool. But, you know, we was going to start a show. Let's talk politics over a beer. Believe you, gun at the door. But I gave up talking politics recently. I talk about political issues. Like right now, there's a issue on the beaches about how all the towns are really not providing the services that are needed on the beach. And it's just, especially in the code enforcement and approvals and all that. And maybe it's a time to look back again and have maybe the county provide the services for like 8 or 9 of the towns and try to do it more efficiently with more.
It's like the craft beer problem. You have the craft town problem because there's so many small towns. There's, you know, 18 or whatever it is, 20 little towns in Pinellas and along the beaches and stuff, all with their own administrations. And
right. And sometimes in the old days, people would volunteer for administrative positions in towns, and there was a lot of volunteerism, and just that doesn't happen anymore, the legality of a lot of things. And so having a professional staff that would oversee maybe all the beaches might save money and be more efficient, leverage technology, all these things, because I just see a lot of frustrated people right now.
You said you aren't talking politics, but you are talking, and that's Beers with Fred. You started a podcast. Talk about the podcast and your hopes for it.
Yeah, so it's funny. Like you were saying, everybody's got access to, you know, making a radio station or putting yourself out there. And I started like 6, 8, 9 months ago watching these YouTubes and started talking to people about the different YouTubes and what was going on. And a buddy of mine said, you really ought to start talking about what you do in your life and open up. And I think people would be interested in it. And, you know, and everything, you know, you think about these things, but But what happened was I actually just met a team of people that said it's really not that expensive to do. And if you try and you're interested, it'll become fun. And literally that's how it happened. And I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. And then I met a, you know, a couple people that have been helping me, and it's really been enjoyable, you know? So, I mean, I love just having a beer and talking, and you and I did a great one. It was fun. And then, you know, basically with AI and other things that can be edited quickly and posted. And then worst case scenario, it's something that's out there. People can say the hope is that maybe it helps our brands, and I'm not looking to, you know, who knows what happens.
Yeah. But, and you've got the studio set up right in the middle of Sea Dog, you know, in the downstairs area there, outdoors, and people can just hang out. And I think, you know, the idea about building community is show up when the podcast is being taped and listen to it and drink and then talk.
Yeah, Treasure Island right there on the first level. That was the one thing that came out of good out of COVID, is that we were able to use that whole downstairs area now. It was all parking, and now we can use it for dining, and we got it approved for the city. So, yeah, we put it right there. And actually, tonight we're doing another show with Joe Rickard, and he's not well enough right now to do it, but his guys are going to do a sports show there tonight. So we'll be going back down. But, yeah, and then when I go up north, I'm going to do the same thing up north from our tasting room. So, and the nice thing about the technology today, I can, you know, we can interview each other, but everybody doesn't have to be right in front of you. Yeah. The other day I introduced and talked with Gordy Gronkowski. He was up in Boston and I was in Treasure Island, and, you know, it was fun and it came out pretty well. So I just saw that video. So it's just on Fred Forsley YouTube, and we'll see where it all goes.
Great. You know, you're getting into a THC brand. How much of a market disruptor for the alcohol space? I've already started to hear about THC spirits, where you can go have a gin and tonic with THC instead of alcohol. So how big of a disruptor do you see that being?
I think alcohol is being disrupted by THC in general. I think over the last 5 or 6 years since the legalization of it in a lot of states, definitely seeing that, and people are wanting to drink other types of products. I think, you know, there's the non-alc category that's blowing up, but this THC drinks are becoming like a fourth category. So I think you're going to see, there's a belief that beer and alcohol will decrease by 20% over the next 5 years. And I don't think that's too far off. I don't think it's going away, but I think that there's a lot of people that they look for other options, you know, and I'm a big believer in, you know, moderation. And I think there's a lot of health benefits in the community part of being able to have a beer or having a drink. But that's the same thing with being able to do it. Like, our drinks are 5 milligrams. So you'd have to drink quite a few of them to really be majorly impaired. But depending on how your resilience is to that product. But I literally would like to have, like, we do a soda. You know, I've talked about some other drinks. We dabbled in coffee. I think, you know, if you get into an industry and you know the logistics and you know the process and you can deal with, you got the infrastructure, people, you know, you've got a finance department, you got people in accounting, you got people. For me, it's almost like do a full portfolio to spread all over the costs that you have. And you're going to have to add, and with technology and other things, it's going to make it more efficient to run. So if I can be known as a beverage guy, or a company can, the evolution for, you know, the next generation will be easier, I hope.
Yeah, so that was actually my next question, is you do seem driven to really fill out the portfolio, introducing more spirits and whatnot. So you see one of the competitive advantages as being you can out efficiency other folks who have to put a whole team of accountants and all that behind one brand, where you can dilute the cost across a bunch of brands. What are some other benefits besides that?
Yeah, it's almost a necessity today, because salespeople are so expensive. Like, put a guy on the street, just the cost of the car, insurance, all the things. You have to be able to expense. So by having that portfolio, you can be able to spend, and, you know, you can't be completely all over the place, but if you can spread it over 3 or 4 brands, you're going to be more effective. And as long as they're not competing brands within your own portfolio, I think you're going to get more attention from distributors. As long as the quality's there and they're going to deal with one supplier that's got 7 products, you're going to be better off. I hope that plays to be true. I got pushed down we did very well in New York City with Pumpkinhead, and we were with a distributor that had maybe 7 or 8 brands. Well, they did one of the biggest mergers, and they all of a sudden ended up with like 30 brands that were major breweries from around, you know, Guinness and so many other, Sam Adams. And all of a sudden we went from being like a 5th or 6th priority to being like a 15th priority. Right. So by having a portfolio, if you can have 1 or 2 that are really growing, then maybe you'll get more attention. It is tricky. It's a tricky, tricky business right now because there are probably more brands in almost any and everything, right? Like there hasn't been a consolidation yet.
And so, you know, you talk about the efficiencies on the back end. There's efficiencies in your power with distributors. Does that map onto the front end with the brand itself, or do you find that it's more potent to really not say, hey, this is our family of brands, and try to kind of just to really go heavy into each brand and make sure they all have their own chance to go really big?
I think you leverage, like if you've done well with Pumpkinhead, the distributor knows at least you know how to manage a brand. So, okay, we'll try that and we'll give that a shot because they almost feel a little bit in. So by bolting on to your successes you've had, I think it makes it a little easier. You do have to give it individual attention and focus. And, you know, at some point you'll end up with a brand manager of each brand and they'll have face with the distributors because you basically have to talk to distributor sales guys and you have to try to sell to the accounts and then you got to sell to the consumers. So you're really selling because you don't sell direct, like, unless you can. But we are trying a little bit of that direct to consumer where we're shipping direct with the alt beverage and stuff for to do with beers because of the laws between the states and the restrictions. And we haven't had as much success. Nobody really has direct to consumer with beer.
Right. And this is a little bit not understanding how the distribution works, but obviously if you brew your own and have your own family of places like you do, that's one way you go through distributors. Are there any businesses that are at least regionally able to sell direct to, you know, from, we just go service the bars ourselves?
Yeah, there have been some breweries that have done it, like in Boston, and then they actually have ended up selling the distribution rights. Stone Brewing out in California actually started a distributor because California let them legally do it. I think in Colorado, some of the breweries have done it in Denver. You can do it if you're in a densely populated area, or if, when I first started, I self-distributed an S10 Blazer and I'm bringing beer around every Friday.
Did you have S10?
Yeah.
Nice.
And
that was my first car.
Yeah. And it was like, oh God. And I started like the first week and I have a beer at every place. And so by the end of the night, I'm having to park the car and walk home. But it's tough to, because you got to think about every stop, and if you the margin is not huge in beer, so you got to somehow come up with ways that you, like, off premise is really where most of the money's made in beer and the shopping centers and that type of thing, because usually on premise you have to spend so much money to promote and, you know, all that, unless you get, you know, certain high volume off on premise accounts.
So what does that mean, off premise?
Off is like retail stores, Publix, and those type of stores. Yeah. So like if you sell 30 cases to Publix and it's dropped off by your distributor, you might make a certain margin on that, but you're not having to do a lot of work as the supplier, as the brewer. You know, the distributors delivered it there and the store may have merchandised some of it, and then you're sold on premise. A lot of times you got to have promotions and other things. Although if you get an account and you get it, it stays, you can over time. That's the thing. But there have been a lot of these rotating taps where people try so many different beers. Now it's starting to settle out a little bit where they're not rotating as many beers in and out.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the future. What's next? You mentioned a couple of brands. Can you be a little more specific about what's coming out next?
Well, so we're working on a rum called Island Time Rum. We've got the trademark on it, and basically some flavored rums. And we're working on a McCloskey's American Whiskey, which my wife's maiden name is McCloskey. They're from the north. I got some funny stories about that. But so we also have a county whiskey we're working on where we're going to distill – barley from northern Maine in an area called the County, which is where the most of the potatoes were grown in Maine and people in the region. But, and we're going to age it. And then, so those are some projects we have going on right now in the spirits game. I've got a brand that my nephew personifies. It's called Climb. And he's the one, Ben Fitzpatrick. He did the Appalachian Trail, and it's going to be a mushroom energy drink, and got that formulated. So those are the exciting things we're going to do right now. And then just keep trying to promote the beers that we've done well over the many years. Pumpkinhead is always our biggest right now, but putting energy back into Blue Paw, the blueberry beer that we do for Sea Dog. And I got a beer called Sunfish, which is a grapefruit peach. And then the Blood Orange is going to be repackaged with Sea Dog, and that'll be able to do variety packs. So those are the things going on. And then just trying to keep everybody in the pubs having fun. And, you know, every one of the locations are a little different. When people are traveling up in Maine, we have a little inn on an island called Peaks Island. It's only a 7-room inn, but we got a nice little pub restaurant there. And it's a mile and a half off Portland, Maine. You take the ferry out, or you take a water taxi, or you're on a friend's boat or whatever. It's a pretty cool place in Maine. So we've got that. It's just opening this weekend. So
I can already feel your wife's fear. Yeah. Once you get a 7-room inn, now what's next? You've got two more hotels in a year. It's my prediction.
No, today we already had that discussion today. It's all, she's pulling the cord. I'm all done.
No more room at the inn.
No more room.
So Beers with Fred Forsley on YouTube, Sea Dog over in the old Captain Cosmaco's location right there near Sunset Beach on Treasure Island. Lots of fun to be had there. Great food. I've enjoyed it myself. And, well, I've enjoyed the conversation, learned a lot, and I appreciate you taking some time.
Cheers. I appreciate it as well.